I want to focus on three key ideas that people often say have been developed later. One is the idea that there are four Gospels. In the New Testament, you open up a Bible and you'll find the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke and John. And some people say that that collection of books is essentially a random collection of books, or it's the collection made by the winners, and they've excluded lots of other books. So that's one idea I want to look at. Second idea, the idea that Jesus is God, as a really late thought development. And third idea, the idea that Jesus rose bodily from the dead. So those are three really key Christian ideas. Let's start with the idea that there are four Gospels. Now, the first complete list saying these are the 27 books of the New Testament actually comes from the 4th century. The first complete copy of the entire New Testament, just down by King's Cross Station, if you go to the British Library, as I'm sure many of you have already been, just go in on the left in the display room, you'll see Codex Sinaiticus there, complete New Testament, and it's from the 4th century. So people say, aha, 4th century, that's when it all happens. Well, 4th century was when Christianity, if you like, came to power, and often I find that Christianity is in a far better position when it doesn't have power, and it's a purer form, if you like. But what we can say is there are plenty of evidences that the four Gospels were held as a special group long before Constantine was born. You could just go over to Dublin, hop on a plane, who is it, EasyJet, Ryanair, whoever takes you there, and get to Dublin, find manuscript P45, which stands for Papyrus 45. In fact, all the images are on the web. It's a bit of a tatty manuscript, bits worn off, leave it. It's a bit tatty, isn't it? And some of the pages are even tattier than that. But it's got all four Gospels in the Book of Acts, and it's from 100 years before the Emperor Constantine, before Christianity came to power. In fact, when Christians were often having a rather hard time. Now, that's a manuscript. Although it's in Dublin, it was not written in Dublin. It came from southern Egypt, which is, of course, where things tend to survive. But that's not the only place where the four Gospels are being used. You could go to France, to Lyon. Anyone been to Lyon, where Irenaeus? No one's been to Lyon. Well, we should take the TGV sometime, and you'll get there in no time. And there you can find someone around the year 185 talking about how having four Gospels is like having four winds. Anyone know anyone called Tatiana? No? No one knows anyone called Tatiana. Well, yeah, you probably are called Tatiana, yeah? No, never mind. But that's a name which comes ultimately from a name called Tatian. And Tatian was a person in the second century. He was a vegetarian. I'm sure some of you are vegetarians as well. That's great. And he actually rolled the four Gospels into one continuous chronological narrative so that all of them were put together. So the idea of having those four Gospels, you know, is already established. And in fact, that left lots of descendants in all sorts of languages. Like some of you will have read Old High German Gospel Harmony, and ultimately that sort of comes from this guy, Tatian, and so on. All sorts of languages. Anyone from Magdalen? Samuel Pepys was there, wasn't he? And left the Pepysian Harmony in Middle English. So there are all sorts of... But that idea of having four Gospels and putting them into one continuous chronological narrative, that goes back to the second century. There are other things I could talk about. So the idea of having four Gospels is not something that arose when Christians had one central power base or when they even had any power. Tatian was in Syria, Irenaeus was in France, and that Gospel manuscript comes from southern Egypt. So in terms of variety, pretty big spatial variety, it seems rather the credentials of those four Gospels are what caused them to be collected together. Second idea, the idea that Jesus is God. Let's have Pliny up if we can, just a few slides. Okay. Pliny was governor of Bithynia, Pliny the Younger, this is, as some of you will know, there are a couple of them, and he writes to the emperor about 80 years after Christianity began, asking for the emperor, in a creepy way, for advice about how to deal with Christians. It's not the earliest reference we have outside the New Testament to Christianity, but it's quite an interesting one. So he talks about these people. He says, I interrogated them as to whether they were Christians. If they confessed, I interrogated them a second and a third time, threatening punishment. If they persisted, I ordered them to be led off, which means led off to execution. As for those who deny that they were or ever had been Christians, when they invoked gods in words given by me and prayed with incense and wine offerings to your statue, which I had ordered to be brought for this very purpose, along with the images of the gods, and also cursed Christ, which it said that no true Christian can ever be compelled to do, I thought they should be discharged. So he's quite a generous guy. I mean, he's a moderate. I mean, you don't bump off every Christian. You just bump off those who persist as Christians, the boneheaded ones, you know, stubborn ones. And he's got this test for whether someone's a Christian. And it's really a test about whether they're prepared to partake in Roman religion, whether they're prepared to worship the Roman gods, worship the emperor, who's a god, and so on. Are they prepared to do that? If they are, everything's okay. But it's a very interesting test because one of the things that it shows is what Christians aren't prepared to do. They aren't prepared to worship the Roman gods. And one of the reasons is because Christianity, as the name suggests, began with Judaism. Because the word Christ is, well, it's ultimately a Greek word which comes from the Hebrew word Messiah, meaning anointed. It's a rather odd word. And so it's all about people who think that the Jewish Messiah, anointed, expected one, has come. So we know that Christianity began in the cradle of Judaism. Well, you know the mathematical answer to the question, how many gods do Jews believe in? The answer? It's too simple for a Cambridge audience. Okay, so one. Let's go on another question. How many gods do Romans believe in? Lots, many. Similarly with Greeks, and you know what can happen, Percy Jackson style, is you know someone can look down from the sky, get together with some Zeus looks down, finds someone else, Poseidon in his case, and you get another half god. So the number of gods can just keep going up. So the mathematical feature about Roman and Greek religion is that the number of gods is not a bounded set. You can just keep on having extra gods. Whereas for Jews, there is only one god. Now, that's going to be important because a lot of people think that gradually over time what happened to Jesus is that people thought at first he's a very special person, then a very, very special person, and then maybe, very, very, very special, and then sort of a bit godlike, and then halfway to God, and then three-quarters of the way to God, and then, all the way. Now, the problem is in a Jewish context, that isn't going to work mathematically. You can't have a time when you have like one and a half gods or one and three-quarters. It isn't allowed. So there isn't really a route from one way to the other within the context of Judaism or within the context of monotheism, the idea that you only have one God. And so it does seem that these early Christians keep that monotheistic idea that you only have one God, and that's why they're not going to worship the emperor. Let's have the next slide. Now he talks about a document which denounced some people as Christians. And Pliny says, others named in the document said that they were Christians, but later denied it, saying that they had been, but they'd ceased 3 years ago or many years ago, or even as much as 20. Then he goes on to describe a Christian meeting as described to him by people who had renounced the Christian faith and were informing him. Now, he's in the year roughly 112, give or take 1 year. And he's talking about people who've given up the faith maybe 20 years ago. So this could get us back to a first century Christian meeting, if you like. They said this had been the full extent of their guilt or error. They'd been accustomed to meet on a fixed day before dawn and to sing antiphonally, one group to another, a song to Christ as to a God, quasi deo. Now, many of you know Latin. No longer compulsory to be at this learned institution, but many of you still know it. And you know that there isn't a word a in Latin, so indefinite article. So we don't know, is this as if to a god, or how should we render it? But one thing we do know is here we have the early Christians who refuse to worship the Roman emperor, refuse to worship the Roman gods, seeming to worship Christ as Deus. And how many deuses do they believe in? I know that's not the plural, but how many gods do they believe in? Well, it seems they only believe in one. So the idea that somehow over a really long period, the idea that Jesus is God has just developed, that's rather problematic because of the root. What happens, it seems, rather is that people early on identify Jesus as the Jewish God. Now, that's quite a thing to get your head round. Because if you believe that God's made everything, there's only one God, to be convinced that an ordinary-looking bloke in front of you actually is that God, and you've always been taught you don't worship humans, is really quite a thing to get your mind round. And that seems to be what the early Christian belief is, that Jesus is one who bears the divine identity. So when you look at early Christian sources, they talk about Jesus having all sorts of roles of judge, creator, someone who can be worshipped, which are things which really in Judaism are exclusively held of God. And so that does seem to be that they are counting Jesus as God. And that's something you can find in documents that are 20, 30 years out from the beginnings of Christianity, which I put, say, 30, 33 AD, depending on when you date the crucifixion. So that's the second idea. Then the third idea is the idea of the resurrection itself, that Jesus came back bodily from the dead. That does seem to be a really early idea. You can find Christian sources. We'll have a couple of them up here if we can have. One from Galatians here. This is the opening verse of a letter that Paul wrote, often dated late 40s, could be early 50s of the first century. And this is just how he begins. You know, Paul, an apostle, he talks about how God has raised Jesus from the dead. In fact, almost all the New Testament documents presuppose that. In fact, many of them argue in relation to it, but many of them just presuppose it. It's not something they're trying to convince their readers of when you look at the rhetorical force of what they're writing. So I would want to say that this is a really early Christian belief. Let's have the next slide. Next slide is where Paul is writing to a group, probably in the late 50s, or mid-50s of the first century, and he will write to them and say, I would like to remind you, brothers, at Alphoi, it's an inclusive term, can include sisters and so on, of the gospel I preached to you, which you received, in which you stand, and by which you are saved, if you hold fast to the word I preached to you. So he reminds them of what he had told them on an earlier visit. He'd in fact been there more than once. I delivered from you, verse 3, as a first importance, so this was a really central thing that he used to teach about, what I also received. In other words, it had gone back before when Paul had become a Christian, that Christ died for our sins in accordance with the scriptures, he was buried, that he was raised the third day in accordance with the scriptures, appeared to Cephas, that's another name for the apostle Peter, then to the 12, and then appeared to more than 500 brothers at one time, most of whom are still alive, though some have fallen asleep, meaning death. Now, the interesting thing is, this is pretty early on that, I mean, he could be bluffing when he talks about 500 people, most of whom are still alive, but it's a risky thing as an apostle if you start, you know, I mean, people who are too big-mouthed and make too big claims tend to lose credibility. So the idea that there are lots of people around who actually saw Jesus risen from the dead seems to be a very early idea. It's not just something around in the 50s. It's something that goes back before Paul became a Christian sometime in the 30s. It's something that's been talked about right from the very beginning. And most people who've looked into it from all sorts of ideological viewpoints, although they don't agree on whether a resurrection took place, they do concede that there was a very early belief in a bodily resurrection. There are still debates about that you can go into. So those three really key ideas that, you know, there are four Gospels and that they will give you the best account of Jesus' life, that Jesus is the Jewish God, and that Jesus rose from the dead. They are things I think we can establish really early on. So there might be all sorts of things that you don't like about Christianity, but for me those are pretty central things. And one of the things we see in this text is not just about the resurrection, but also about the death of Jesus, that he died, but not just that he died. I mean, lots of people agree, widely agreed, the crucifixion and so on, even dates for it proposed to within, you know, I think, only two possible dates. But in terms of him dying, there's actually something more. It says, died for our sins. And he says that was a really central part of the Christian message. Not just the idea that Jesus died, but also that he did it because of people's sins and in a substitutionary way, sort of swapping, taking their place, so that people, because of his sacrifice, could actually get out of their sins in some way. Now, that's a bit weird, and you're going to need to have that unpacked, but it's an absolutely key thing. Because it's not just that Jesus isn't like the Crusades in the sense that he goes and sort of is weak at that key point, that he gives up himself. It's not just that in terms of Christ being an example, and if we're all peaceful like him, you know, what a better place the world would be. There's actually something more in it, and that is the idea that we have done wrong things, our sins, and that he has done something which can take the consequences of that away. I would argue it's a question of justice, that might take a little bit more argument, that we have done wrong things that actually deserve punishment, and that he has died taking punishment in our place so that if we believe in him, we can actually have a restored relationship with God. But that's something I'm very happy to talk about further personally or in questions. But I've taken enough time, and you've listened very patiently, so over to you.
Right, so I think the question is, Jesus gets called Lord. What does that say about his status in relation to God? Well, you know, the word that's used throughout the New Testament, the Greek word kurios, it can be used in all sorts of different levels. At one level, it can be just used for a sir, a polite thing. On the other hand, at another level, it can be used for absolute master, and it can also be used for this is a title of God. And when you read through the Gospels, one of the great things is that you can actually see a variety of different uses of that. But there are certainly some of them, and within Paul's letters, where it seems to be saying Jesus is Lord in the sense that God is. And so in 1 Corinthians 8, there's a passage where it says there's one God and there is one Lord. Or in one of Paul's letters to a group in Philippi, the Philippians, he talks about how Jesus is going, every knee will bow and say Jesus is Lord, which is a really striking thing because the language of that text comes from an Old Testament passage where that title Lord is ascribed to God. And so you get this sort of use sometimes of things that are only used or used in a way that suggests that Jesus himself is being identified as God by the use of that title. But the word on its own isn't quite enough to clinch that.
How are the books of the New Testament Gospels chosen? Why were some left out?
Thank you. Some questions are presuppose information. So presupposing that some things are left out. I mean, apart from the fact that not everything is in the New Testament. The idea that there was a sort of deliberate process of, say, excluding Gospels, I don't think is there. I think what you have a case, and also when you talk about how were they chosen, that can slightly presuppose a model. Let's ask the question, how was the winner of the marathon at the Olympics chosen? Well, there is a panel of judges, but the panel of judges really only gets involved if there's a photo finish. It's pretty unlikely in a marathon, or some sort of infraction. And otherwise, how they got chosen was effectively someone just being way out ahead. And so I'd want to say that the fact that in France, Syria, and southern Egypt, the four Gospels are being used and accepted by groups when there doesn't seem to be a central group with the power to impose the four Gospels on anyone, rather suggests that the credentials of those four Gospels has actually made them win out. So I think it's really, you could say that your supervisor chooses the books that you get on your reading list, and that is very true. But you could also say that there are some books that are just not of a sufficient merit that they're ever going to get on a reading list. There's a dialogue in a sense, and so I want to say that there is a lot of the credentials of the Gospels that help them win out. The other thing is, I'd say the Gospels themselves claim to be from God, so they are actually making a sort of either-or claim. You either have to accept that phenomenal claim that they are God's speech or not. If I can illustrate, the very first phrase in the Bible, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. In the beginning. That's how one of the four Gospels begins. In the beginning was the Word. It's how John's Gospel begins. And people at the time when John's Gospel was written, the Jews, believe that that first book of the Bible, Genesis, is one of God's really special books. And here, John's Gospel comes along and seems to be claiming, I'm the same sort of book. That's a really radical claim. Either you accept that this is another time that God really is speaking in that special way, or you reject it. But it's not, again, that gradually over time it gets assigned to have more and more authority. And I think you could make similar arguments with the other Gospels as well.
Yeah.
How different would you say the sort of belief about Jesus as God, etc., that would have been promoted by St. Paul would be to the one that sort of would be had by the people in Jerusalem and the actual disciples on the day. So,
yeah.
How that
influenced
the way
that these perfect. Thank you. So, the idea is just about 200 years old that there was a major difference of opinion between Paul, who wrote lots of the letters in the New Testament, and the apostles who were part of the 12 sent out by Jesus. But within the New Testament text, I don't think you see any difference of opinion as to Jesus being God. That is, I think I could find that in every book, implicitly or explicitly, or the logical structure only works that way. So it's not just in Paul, but, you know, end of Matthew, all authority is given to this one. Beginning of Mark, first couple of verses in, I'm sending my messenger ahead of you. That's a bit of the Old Testament saying ahead of God. And then along comes John the Baptist as the messenger ahead of Jesus. And you know, it's right in there at the beginning. So each, you know, chapter 2 of Mark, who can forgive sins but God alone, and there's Jesus forgiving sins. So each time we're getting an association between Jesus and God, and that's going right the way throughout these texts. So it's not just in Paul.
So are you suggesting that the synoptic Gospels in John were written by the actual disciples as opposed to later by people who have been interested in
I think that Matthew and John were written by Matthew and John, who are of the 12 disciples. Mark doesn't claim to be a disciple, but I think he got his information from Peter, who was. That's an early tradition and also fits with internal evidence. Luke wasn't an apostle. In fact, there would be no reason to ascribe anything to Luke, because he would be nobody if it weren't for the gospel with his name on. You know, but he does claim to have gone round and checked things out. And he was someone who I think flourished as a writer in the 50s, so he's not someone very removed from the events.
Thank you. What would you say about the chunk at the end of Mark's Gospel, which isn't found in earlier manuscripts? Is it a problem?
In earlier printed Bibles, you'll find that there are Mark's Gospel goes up to 16 verse 20, and in more recently printed ones, it tends to say that the end of the Gospel is at verse 8, and I would go with the more recently printed Bibles. The last 12 verses not found in the very earliest manuscripts. Is it a problem? Yes, in the sense that people disagree about it, and it's a problem in that different churches will have different understandings of that, and so that's a problem. On the other hand, one of the nice things about Bible manuscripts is that they differ. And what that shows is that there hasn't been any group which has conspired to make them all the same. The fact that they're in different museums, different monasteries, different countries, no organisation has ever been able to control them all. No pope, no emperor has ever had command of all the different languages the Bible's been translated into, and so on. So in terms of clarity of evidence, it's all there. And what I can say is this, that thing about the last 12 verses of Mark, and also about this 12 verses in John's Gospel, which are generally, by modern scholars and most of the modern translations, not thought to be part of the authentic text. Those have been known about for the whole history of the church. So they're known about 500 years ago and before that. But scholars knew about that when Erasmus, who was in Queens, made his first Greek New Testament. And he did that on the basis of 6 manuscripts. Now we've got about 6,000 manuscripts. So the number of known manuscripts has just gone up by about 1,000. And no new major uncertainties have come to be known. It's a rather remarkable thing that the amount of evidence increased. But what we haven't found is that's been increasing uncertainty. And so you can actually do a calculation from that to work out just how certain the rest of the stuff is. So you know it's not all gone through some editing, you know, to make all the evidence uniform. And yet there is, within that, a lot of uniformity. Now, that's a sort of complex argument I need more time to unpack, but that's actually my...